Good morning. You may be seated. First case on our calendar is the State of Ohio versus Troy Matthew Tennis. Mr. Gamzo.
Thank you. Good morning. I'd like to reserve 10 minutes, if I might, for rebuttal, please. May it please the court. In January 1994, a terrible thing happened. Troy Tennis is responsible for that. Nobody disputes either of those things. What exactly happened is the substance of six of the seven case-specific assignments of error. In this case, it's our position, basically, that Mr. Tennis is not, in fact, guilty of aggravated murder and is not death eligible, but in fact it's involuntary manslaughter. The seventh of those case-specific assignments of error, and the one that I actually want to talk about this morning, takes the verdict as it comes, because the jury did indeed find him guilty of aggravated murder, find him guilty of the death specification, sentenced him to die. What I want to actually insist is that they're wrong. That in this case, on these facts, assuming that he is in fact guilty of aggravated murder and death specification, that does not come even close to outweighing the mitigating factors in this case. The task that is set by the General Assembly in trying to figure out who ought to be sentenced to die and who not seems to me to be inherently an impossible task. We do it. Juries do it. Trial judges do it. Appellate courts, in this case and other cases, have done it. This court does it. It strikes me as essentially an impossible task to weigh on one side the aggravating circumstance or circumstances of the case. In this case, there's only one. And on the other side, the mitigating factors of a person's life. This is not, it seems to me, like weighing apples and oranges, two things which are dissimilar, but at least they're both fruit. This is like weighing apples and Oldsmobiles. They're not even in the same category. Nevertheless, it is a task that we are faced with. And it seems to me that in order to understand why I think the jury went wrong, lower courts have gone wrong on this question, it's necessary to think about how we actually must go about that process of weighing. One of the things the Court of Appeals said in this case is that aggravating circumstances are fungible. They're all the same. That when you do the weighing process, whatever goes on the aggravating circumstance side of the scale, perhaps multiple circumstances would be different. They didn't address that question because there is only one in this case. But whatever goes on that side of the scale is of equal weight, so that a course of conduct specification involving the deaths of dozens is no more weighty than any other aggravating specification, than any other aggravating circumstance. That it is apparently no weightier, no worse, to kill a police officer in the line of duty than to do one of the other things that constitutes an aggravating circumstance. The cold calculus of a contract killing is apparently, according to the Court of Appeals, no worse than any other aggravating circumstance. I'd suggest that's just not true. I think that's nonsense, in fact. I think there's no reasonable way to say that all these aggravating circumstances, which are, after all, not the facts and not the nature and circumstances of the offense, but a specific statutory factor, it is nonsense to presume that they all weigh exactly the same.
Mr. Gamzo, are you suggesting that the A7 felony murder is the least of the aggravating circumstances? Is that what you're going to argue?
I'm going to end up there, yes, Your Honor. And certainly, if not the least, that it is far from the most. I can't tell you, and I'm not happily forced to try and figure out what order to rank the various circumstances in. What I'm convinced of, what I think is in fact self-evident, is that some are worse than others. And that among the very worst of all these, and none of them are good, they're all terrible, terrible things. I don't mean to suggest otherwise. But that among these lists of things that one must not do, that are the most horrible of crimes, some are in fact more horrible than others. And then what seems to me to follow, because I think inherently that felony murder, and even within felony murder, perhaps one could rank some felonies are worse than, but I'm not going to go there. What we have here is aggravated murder in the course of, and that Mr. Tenace was found guilty of aggravated murder as the principal offender while in the course of committing an aggravated robbery. It's not the worst of the aggravating circumstances that's out there, not even close. And if that's so, then that tells us something about how we have to weigh that and how we have to factor it in. There is, I would suggest, a synergistic relationship between the weight of the aggravating circumstance and the weight of the mitigating factors. That is, when you get to the worst of the aggravating circumstances, it's going to take more mitigation to provide some kind of balance. That stands to reason. As the weight of the aggravating circumstance decreases, weighty though it is, terrible though it is, as that weight decreases, so it takes less in the way of mitigating circumstance to rise up. Now, as we read the opinions of this court, as we read the opinions of lower courts, the courts of appeals and the cases that have gone through those, of trial courts, what we see routinely is this mitigating circumstance gets some weight. This one has a little weight. This one has a fair amount of weight. This one has... These are not clearly quantifiable terms, and it's not quantifiable easily how much weight anything should have on either side of this scale. I understand that. What we never see, and what I'm coming back to again and again, what we never see is the weight that goes to the aggravating circumstance. It is great. We know that. How great, how much, what does it take to balance it? It seems to me that what we have here is an enormous amount of mitigation. Troy has damaged goods. If you read his background, as you go through the record and look at what is in his background, it is horrifying. It is appalling. The trial judge wrote, lifting words from other opinions, that while his experiences are unfortunate, they are not uncommon. Well, that's nonsense. Of course they're uncommon. And the court concluded, many other people have endured similar experiences without resorting to lawlessness. Well, many people have certainly had terrible backgrounds and not become criminals. That's true. It is not true that anybody has had the same background as Troy Tenace and not resorted to lawlessness. He had two siblings. They were raised essentially together. At the time of this trial, all three of them were incarcerated. I mean, the simple math is that in this family, with this background, in fact, you do resort to lawlessness. There's no getting around it. Troy has damaged goods. If not this specific thing was predictable, certainly horrors were predictable for him. He had no chance. As a practical matter, he had no chance in this world. He was a drug addict. He did, in fact, seek treatment on several occasions. It didn't work. He takes some blame for that, of course, but it didn't work. And he went and sought treatment again, and it didn't work, and he takes blame for that. He also ought to get some credit for at least trying to address the problem. But it also goes to who this person is, that he's damaged, that he's not all there. He suffered.
Counsel,
yes.
You're making an argument here that it's almost impossible to weigh the aggravating against the mitigating, given the system that we have in place. That you're saying the more heinous the crime, the more aggravating the circumstances, it would take a tremendous amount of mitigation to overcome. And here, since you're saying that this is the least of the aggravating, it shouldn't take as much mitigation to overcome it. And these are all nebulous terms. And the statute doesn't provide for a scoring system. And absent, and it seems to me that you would prefer that there was a scoring system here where you get points for aggravation and aggravating circumstances and then points for mitigating, and you just do the math.
It would be easier, certainly.
Well, certainly it would be easier, but
it would be easier. It would horrify me.
And the subject matter doesn't lend itself to that type of quantification.
The subject matter doesn't lend itself to it. I suspect that the U.S. Supreme Court would find such a system, in fact, unconstitutional,
right,
insofar as it demands individualized consideration. Yes, it would be simpler because it would tell us how to do this,
What you just said, individualized consideration, and are you stating that the court failed to afford that here, individualized consideration?
If it gave it, it got it wrong. In part, I think it didn't give it. I think the claim that Mr. Tenace's background was not uncommon, that lots of people have it and don't commit, it's silly. It's just wrong. And so if that's individualized consideration, I don't think it is. And if it is, it's just grossly wrong. I think that when the court did other things wrong. When the Court of Appeals said that the trial court's opinion, in fact, weighed the nature and circumstances of the offense on the side of aggravation, which it can't do, we know that. So I think there's no question that the trial court's judgment was wrong, in part. Now, is it wrong when you get through the whole thing? I think it is. I think that a fair reading of the record shows that in this case, on these facts, given this mitigation, given this aggravating circumstance, given this crime and this person, Troy ought to spend the rest of his life in prison.
Mr.
And that's the alternative. As a practical matter, that's the alternative. Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Gamzo, there were two trials in this case. Is that correct?
Yes.
And in each case, the 12 jurors also made the balancing and came up with the same conclusion. Is that correct?
As a matter of historical fact, that's accurate.
All right.
I think that is, I'd like to say we could put it out of our minds as we tell jurors to ignore those things that are irrelevant and believe that they actually do. I don't think that it is relevant. I think that the question is not what did 12 jurors the first time conclude. It's not 24 jurors got it wrong, because this case was not tried the second time to 24 jurors. It was tried to 12 jurors. There was the mitigation that was presented at this trial against the aggravation and the evidence that was presented at this trial. That is the record in front of this court now. It is 12 jurors that are the issue, not 24. Difficult as that is to separate out, I think it must be separated out. You're not asked to reverse two cases, you're asked to reverse one. And I think, well, once again, I mean, we know that he has serious psychological disorders. Dr. Janisworth's testimony is essentially unrebutted, but the list of things, post-traumatic stress disorder, substance abuse dependence disorder, dysthymic disorder, antisocial personality disorder. We know that he is loved and cared for by his mother, by his sister, by his brother. That is worth something. This court has recognized that as being worth something in other cases. We know that he has consistently and repeatedly, from the day that he was arrested, expressed deep remorse for what happened.
Well, counsel, his behavior prior to the arrest, if I recall, was an attempt to try and evade and get away and said to the, in fact, the person who transported him, I got to get out of town, et cetera, et cetera. He was not...
He did not go and turn himself in, no. He tried to avoid getting caught. There's no getting around that.
Okay, and you classify this individual as damaged goods, and I don't think that anybody reading his background and the way he was raised and the character development as fostered by his mother could indicate anything otherwise. However, the way I read it, he's of average intelligence. There's no indication here that he is learning disabled or suffers any impairment in his cognitive functioning.
That's correct.
And he had been exposed repeatedly to the criminal justice system prior to this latest crime.
Yes.
The attempts at rehabilitation for his chemical dependency was through court order, not a voluntary recognition and desire to clean up his act, so to speak.
But he did participate in those efforts, and they didn't work, obviously.
You know, there's a lot of people that participate in those efforts when the court is directing them, and it's a contingency to a sentence. You're basically arguing a proportionality.
Well, proportionality, not in the sense that this court does proportionality review, is how does this case measure up against this case and that case and that case and that case? I mean, we addressed that in the briefs. This is the proportion of is this appropriate? Is this the right guy? Is this, on these circumstances, given what he did, should we lock him up forever or should we kill him? That's the question. I mean, that really is the question. Nobody's talking about setting him free, about him going off and wandering the streets of Ohio or any place else again. He's not getting out. We know that. I mean, he was available before trial. He is available now. He can have a sentence that makes him first eligible for parole at a time when he's well up into his 80s. He is not going to be wandering the streets again. That's a given. The question is, what do we do with him? Does he die in prison on our hands, or does he die in prison of natural circumstances or whatever exactly? That's the question here. And he, in fact, said, going back to that first trial, he said, in fact, I don't know how, in his unsworn statement, I don't know how you live. How you people, he said to the jury, how you live out here every day. He can't do it. He knows that. We know that. He ought not be wandering around the streets, but that's not the alternative. The question is, what is the sentence that he deserves on these facts, given who he is, what he has been through, the people who care for him, the people he cares for? It seems to me that when you look at all that, and when you weigh that against the fact that, and I keep saying it, and I don't really, really, really do not wish to demean the crime and the seriousness of what he did. There are worse things he could have done. There are more horrible things that he could have done. People do those things. You see those things every day. We read about them in the newspaper every day. If death row is for the worst of the worst who do the worst things, he's not one of the people who belongs there. Now, you have to do an independent
way. Counsel, I have a little trouble with you trying to single this out as being stacked up against a class of crimes that are not death penalty eligible and saying that this is on the lower spectrum of crimes that are death penalty eligible and the circumstances which would trigger that for the aggravating circumstance. There's a classification of crimes that are death penalty eligible.
Yes.
He committed one of those crimes.
He was found guilty of it, certainly.
And within that structure, then, there is a system in which to evaluate the aggravating versus the mitigating circumstances.
Yes.
And that's all we're looking at here.
That's
he is already in that arena. He is not compared to somebody who robs a bank or steals a car or embezzles or just some other type of crime. He is only eligible for the punishments to be meted out to someone who is guilty as convicted by the jury. And then you want us to further weigh within that structure which he finds himself and look for a minimization within the categories.
And a maximization, yeah.
But the law doesn't, Mr. Gamzo,
right,
the law doesn't provide for that the way you would have us review this case.
I think the law precisely does provide for it.
Where?
The law says, here is how I read 2903 and 4. It says that under these circumstances, if a person is convicted of aggravated murder on one or more of these statutory specifications, that person then becomes eligible for a death sentence. Then we go to a second phase of the trial at which evidence in mitigation is presented. That evidence, which is believed by the jury, by the individual jurors, actually, by a preponderance of the evidence, is weighed against the statutory aggravating circumstance or circumstances of which the defendant was convicted.
And that was done here?
It was done. The process occurred.
Okay.
No question about that. If the answer is wrong, is sufficiently wrong, and that's why the legislature set up at the same time multiple levels of review, right? It says the jury has to decide that. Then the trial judge has to make that decision. Mm-hmm. Then, because this is an old law case, the Court of Appeals has to make. In each case, the decision is made independently by the body. And then this court is required to do an independent review to determine whether the aggravating circumstance or circumstances, in fact, outweighs beyond a reasonable doubt the mitigating factors. Okay? Required by the General Assembly to weigh these things. Can you say, I suppose you can, all aggravating circumstances, once again, we don't have a weight to assign these things, but let's just pluck a number out of the air for purposes of talking about it. All aggravating circumstances weigh 12. 12 of whatever. And then we, you know, add weights on the mitigating factors side, and they weigh whatever they weigh, and it comes out however it comes out. Can you do that? I suppose you can do that. That, in fact, seems to be what this court has done without ever assigning the weight to the aggravating factor, to the aggravating circumstance. What every court does, in fact, without assigning any weight to the aggravating. And what I'm suggesting is that's wrong.
Is it not likely that jurors do precisely what you are suggesting we should tell them to do, that if you take the case with the worst aggravating circumstance, whatever that may be, that a jury is likely to require more mitigation to offset or to balance?
I hope so.
They're not told to do that, certainly, but intuitively, wouldn't we think that that's probably what they do?
I would certainly hope that's what they do.
You don't want to trust intuition.
I would hope that's what they do. It seems to me courts don't do that as a rule, and certainly they don't say that they're doing that. And the Court of Appeals in this case very specifically said all aggravating circumstances are fungible. That means they're all the same. You can shuffle them around; it doesn't make any difference. They are fungible. That's what the Court of Appeals said. I think that's wrong. I agree with you, Your Honor. I hope jurors intuitively try and fix that and not do that and work it out right. And I hope so. In this case, they got it wrong. That's what I am standing here saying.
Mr. Gamzo, the statute to which you refer, 29-2904, says in part, if I'm right, the court, trial, jury, or panel of judges shall consider and weigh against the aggravating circumstances proved beyond a reasonable doubt the nature and circumstances of the offense. That would include the age of the victim, would it not, and the nature of the commission
of the
offense?
All those things go on the side of mitigation.
Well, if there, in fact there could be mitigation there.
If there's, I'm not, there is no mitigation in the nature and circumstances of this offense.
Pardon me?
I'm not suggesting there is any mitigating value to the nature and circumstances of this offense.
Well, that's why I question your comment that those go to mitigation. I'm wondering, the fact is they are to be considered by the court prior to imposing the sentence.
They are to be considered.
And so there is consideration that the victim was 78 years old, that he was strangled, that he was attacked in his home, and all of those things would be weighed, presumably, by those who have reviewed the aggravating circumstance against, as it says in the statute, the nature and circumstances of the offense, history, character, and background of the offender, and whether the victim induced the crime. It's unlikely that it would have been committed but for duress or provocation, the mental disease or capacity or lack thereof of the defendant. His youth isn't a factor here. Lack of significant criminal history, his participation as other than a principal offender, which isn't applicable apparently, and other factors relevant to death. And then it says the existence of mitigating factors does not preclude the imposition of a sentence of death on the offender, but shall be weighed in accordance with the other circumstances. So,
this court has...
it is a determination that was made by presumably those who had considered not only the aggravating circumstance, but all those other factors in the statute, which we've discussed here, nature and circumstances and the other considerations, and that is the review that was conducted.
One assumes. I mean, according to the Court of Appeals, the trial court did it wrong. It put the nature and circumstances of the offense on the wrong side of the ledger. So, I mean, did the trial court consider it? Yes. Did it consider it right? No. I mean, that's a decided factor in this case. But yes, one assumes that those things were considered. But the statute, because it also specifically says that the trial court, after the jury makes a determination, the trial court is supposed to make an independent determination.
Yes.
Trial court has to weigh those things by itself. Then the Court of Appeals, if affirmed, has to weigh those things independently.
You are correct.
This court has to weigh those things independently. So in some sense, yes, I know those 12 jurors sit out there and the trial judge sits there and the three-judge panel sits there, and we can't pretend those things did not happen. But in fact, that's not your job. Your job is not to say, is there sufficient evidence to support the verdict?
No.
Your job is to say, was it right? An independent review, what's the answer? I have 2.5 minutes
You don't
left.
Look at this as a ledger, though. The aggravating circumstance of the commission of the aggravated murder during commission of a felony, as opposed to everything on the other side. I mean, it is consideration of all of the factors as to weighing, mitigating against the aggravating circumstances.
Yes, that's the job.
Okay.
No question. I have just over 2 minutes left. I'd like to reserve them.
Thank you, Mr. Gamzo.
Thank you, Mr. Gamzo. Mr. Pearson.
Craig Pearson for the State of Ohio. May it please the court. Mr. Gamzo has indicated that there are essentially two issues in this case. Obviously, for the last 20 minutes or so, everybody's been talking about mitigation. The other issue, though, that he mentioned that form several of the assignments of error concern sufficiency of the evidence and weight of the evidence, and I'd just like to spend a few minutes talking about that. The defendant in this case went to the
Counsel, before you do, why don't you spend some time talking about what he talked about? Because if I understood him, he stood up and said, you know, there really isn't much doubt as to the fact that his client committed the crime. But he argues, if I understand him, that what the jury did, what the trial court did, what the Court of Appeals did, are all out there. But today, this case is here, and the statute puts on us the obligation to do an independent weighing. And by independent weighing, I believe the statute means, doesn't matter what all of those tribunals before us did. We've got to look this question squarely in the eye and make an independent judgment, our judgment, irrespective of what the jury did or anybody else. I think that's his argument.
Yes, absolutely.
So could you address that?
And you're quite—he's quite correct as a legal matter. That's quite correct. I did not take Mr. Gamzo to be conceding the issues of sufficiency and manifest
right.
weight. So that's why. I mean, I won't address that. I'll go right into the mitigation.
You'll have 20 minutes. But I'm interested in hearing your response to what he just raised with us.
Okay. Well, the first thing is that although this court has to do an independent weighing, that doesn't mean that it has to be turn a blind eye to the fact that there were two juries that. That unanimously concluded that not only did
You're just suggesting we don't independently weigh, that we
over
our shoulder and say, well, what did these other folks do? That's not independently weighing.
Well, it's...
Let's independently weigh it, and let's hear you address that.
All right. Well, first of all, there's the first thing that Mr. Gamzos is arguing is that there should be a ranking of the aggravating circumstances. And unfortunately, the statute doesn't provide for that. The Ohio legislature didn't provide
okay,
for that.
When we're independently weighing, if this defendant had murdered a drug dealer and a drug deal gone awry. Would that be different than if he had murdered a policeman who came out to quell a domestic disturbance?
I think it would probably, as a practical matter, make a difference to any trier of fact, whether it's this court or whether it's a jury or whether it's the Court of Appeals. As a matter of legality, I don't believe it does matter. What the aggravating circumstances do is set the criteria for who becomes death eligible. And at that point, what effectively happens in the mitigation phase is, well, the mitigation phase is for the defense. If the defense waives mitigation and there's nothing to weigh against the aggravating circumstances, then death is pretty much mandatory at that point, a death sentence. So consequently, what happens in as a practical matter at trial is that the guilt phase is for the prosecution. What happens in the mitigation phase is the prosecution generally doesn't put on witnesses, but instead lets, as happened in this case, let the defense put on the four witnesses and then subjected them to cross-examination and then made their arguments to the court, to the jury. About the weighing, and then let the jury make up its mind.
Counsel, can you point to any decision from our court where the childhood circumstances, the upbringing of the child, has been so horrific that it's presented sufficient mitigation to merit not giving the death penalty?
I can't recall of one personally. No.
What circumstance would be bad enough? I mean, this person as a child had about one of the worst childhoods you could imagine in terms of the abuse, the drugs, the alcohol, his parents forcing him to commit crimes as a young child, all the medical problems or mental problems he develops as a result of that. What do you need to add to this fact pattern to make it bad enough to mitigate against the death penalty?
I'm not sure that there is anything alone, standing alone, in terms of just the background of the individual that would justify that. It would have to, but that would have to be coupled with other factors showing, I think, the low intelligence, the lack of, or the mental illness in this case was minimal. I mean, low-grade, long-term depression. I mean, I don't want to bring in things outside of the record, but you should see my medicine cabinet, and I haven't murdered anyone.
Do you then, can you envision any factual scenario from a childhood that standing alone is enough?
That standing alone would be enough. It would be, if it warped the child to such an extent that essentially the child couldn't, had as a practical matter, no social skills or concern, you know, whatsoever, and that could be directly attributed to the upbringing. Then it is. I will concede that there is a possibility of a person's background being so horrific that it would do that. But in this case, I don't believe it's nearly as bad as a lot of the backgrounds of many people in the cases, death penalty cases, that have come in front of this court. There have been other people who have been much more heavily addicted. There have been other defendants who have been much more heavily and severely abused, who have developed much more serious mental problems. And in this case, essentially his bad background, his horrific background, which I would concede was horrific. I'm not going to minimize the.
Well, there's no question there's mitigation here, but isn't our duty to determine each case on its own merits and to consider only the facts that are presented to us here?
Well, of course.
Isn't that the responsibility?
But I'm assuming that there's you're going to want to draw some kind of guidance from what's been done by this court in the past.
I'd like to go back to your response to Justice Papers' question to you about, is it a more serious capital case if the victim is a police officer, et cetera. And looking at 2904 criteria for imposing death or imprisonment for capital offenses, it simply lists a number of things, offenses for committed for hire, and they do mention where the victim is a police officer. It appears that they are all basically equal. Isn't that true? You said that it would be more serious if it was a police officer.
Well, I said that as a practical matter, I can't imagine a finder of fact not having that effect.
But according to the statute,
they're all equal.
They're all equal.
There is no ranking. It's all of those. Any of those things qualify the person for death, and then essentially there's simply an aggravating circumstance or circumstances. In this case, there was one. He committed aggravated murder in the course of committing aggravated robbery. That's it. I mean, that's pretty dry, isn't it?
Also true that this defendant, during his, I believe, high school years, was put in an after-school treatment program, which he did not cooperate with, and it was discontinued?
That's my understanding,
and
yes.
And we heard from Mr. Gamzo that he was ordered into drug treatment numerous times, and it all failed. While I recognize that his childhood certainly is not desirable, and he did live through some terrible things, but there's a point in everyone's life, isn't there, where we have to take some responsibility. And we have seen people who have come out of situations like this where they've accomplished great things. So the question was asked of you, can you recall a case from this court where that was sufficient mitigation to do away with the death penalty? I don't recall any cases of that nature. We do take that into consideration. That certainly would be part of mitigation.
Yeah.
Count, counsel.
Sorry.
Well, I'm sorry. Wait.
No, go, no.
You were going to respond to Justice Resnick, so do that first. And then.
Well, I was going to respond in the sense that the state would concede that that he had a horrific background. But there also is a laundry list of other things that the appellant is, you know, trying to throw in, such as the fact that he confessed, you know. But as has already been pointed out so far, he didn't confess until he was apprehended. He tried to avoid being apprehended to get some money and get out of town. And then when he was apprehended, his so-called confession wasn't complete. I mean, he never admitted ever touching, ever hitting or kicking the man. So, you know, how he died is apparently his version of it was that they scuffled and then they both kind of fell to the floor and the fellow hit his head. So he wasn't even truthful in that. So I don't consider that a confession per se. And this business about him being a loving father. I mean, you know, well, he was a loving father, but apparently in his court-ordered drug treatment, that wasn't sufficient motivation for him to you know, get his act together and try to get off the coke. So, I mean, I don't really consider giving that a whole lot of weight. They also brought up in the brief, haven't brought up an oral argument, brought up in the brief, the fact that he offered to plea if the death penalty was taken off the table. But and that's presumably, according to the appellant, suggests that he's taking responsibility for his action. How they can derive that conclusion from that premise is beyond me. He's trying to avoid the death penalty. He's not taking responsibility. The fact that he's going to have a long incarceration if death isn't imposed. The legislature is listed seven, essentially, aggravating circumstances that qualify a person for death, that say that these things are so heinous that they in fact deserve death. And so consequently, I think that the long incarceration argument is a non sequitur. His depression, well, I already commented on that. This antisocial personality disorder, that's a code word for being a criminal.
But, you know, Mr. Pearson, all of his conditions to which you refer were created by adults who abused him, who introduced him to cocaine. His mother got him hooked on cocaine, drugs, taught him how to, at 7 years old, taught him how to steal. Why is that not strong enough mitigation? As you know, I've dissented in at least one or two cases where I thought that kind of mitigating circumstance or that kind of mitigating evidence should have outweighed the aggravating circumstances in favor of vacating the death penalty. This one is not as bad, frankly, as the one, I can't remember the name of the case, but not as bad as the one where I dissented. But every condition he has, it seems to me, was created by his mother and this Mr. Senna, whoever the boyfriend or the man friend who abused him, sexually abused him. And now we have, very predictably, a criminal, an adult criminal. And as Mr. Gamzo says, the choice here is not between letting him roam the streets again. The choice is between whether he stays in prison, dies in prison, after a life sentence, or he dies in the electric chair or with an injection or whatever we do now. Why doesn't this case meet the standard for saying this person, he's 31 years old, that's in your favor because he's had some time to understand what society expects of him. But this man started at ground zero when he became an adult, didn't he? He had no help from his parents, none at all. Why should we put him to death?
Well, I think that largely because when you look at the background, much of that, of course, has gone unchallenged and went unchallenged by the prosecution and mitigation. Except that, for example, you talked about getting them involved in crime. His mother testified, and when she asked, "Well, how many? You know, how often did you get him involved in that?" Her answer was, one, two times, you know, that. So, I mean, it's not like he was, you know, she was the equivalent of Fagin and you know, had this.
Well, not just him, but his siblings also. This is quite a crime. This family was great. They knew how to go out and steal and rob, and all because the parents, the mother and this man, taught them how to do it at a very young age. What do we expect?
Yes.
He has to really, we say, well, some people go through that and they come out all right. Yes, they're fortunate. But that's not the issue here to me. The issue here is, what do we do with this individual who came out of that cauldron of hate and abuse and crime, and we say, well, you should have shaped up and you shouldn't have murdered. Obviously you shouldn't have murdered. But to take his life when he had that kind of a start in life.
Well, Your Honor, I would say to that, or I'd point out that the testimony in mitigation indicated to me, it was a cold record, of course, but then it's going to be a cold record for you too. But it indicated to me that his mother had it a lot worse than he did, and that his sister, in fact, suffered quite a bit more than he did as well. But as for his brother, apparently not as much. But neither of them ended up, they both ended up in prison, but neither of them ended up committing murder or anything nearly as serious.
We can look at this, the mitigating factors the jury is to take into consideration the history, character, and background of the offender. We can look at that in a different way rather than as a positive mitigating factor. It could be looked at, in this case, as a negative factor, since his life has been just filled with crime. And if we were to reverse the death penalty, there's no saying what this man would do while he is spending life in prison. Wouldn't that be something to be taken into consideration?
I think it's a very good point, because murders do happen on death row. Murders happen in prison.
They happen on death row?
Oh, yeah.
Heard of suicides.
No, murders have happened, at least according to the federal statistics. I mean, I don't know how they figured that out, but, yeah, there have been murders on death row.
If we were to reverse the death penalty,
he
would not be on.
Right, he'd be in the population, which would make it even worse. My point was there are murders that are committed even on death row.
We've had very heinous cases coming before us of crimes occurring in prison.
Yeah, absolutely, and that would be another consideration. Also, the age factor. As pointed out by Chief Justice Moyer, does act in the state's favor, and I think fairly significantly, because he is 31. He's not. I mean, you could say, well, he should have gotten his act together and overcome this and accepted responsibility as an adult and conformed his behavior to the dictates of society
Counsel,
after he became an adult, but
Counsel,
31?
Mr. Gamzo, actually rather gently, has touched a nerve, certainly with me, perhaps the entire court. Justice Stratton raised the question, has this court ever set aside the imposition of death based on the background and upbringing, or for that matter, in a pure weighing, independent weighing that we're required to do, have we ever said that the mitigating circumstances or mitigating factors outweigh the aggravating? Maybe that's not a fair question to you. I wouldn't expect you would have researched that. I can't recall it. I can recall the chief arguing in a dissent in one or two cases that the independent weighing should have us set aside the death. I have used the independent weighing in a number of circumstances where I felt it really wasn't a death case, that the prosecution was wrong to bring it, that the kidnapping was bogus or whatever it is that was used to get to felony murder, or that there were problems, in my view, or I think in a case or two, if I'm recalling correctly, for me, when we get to this threshold, I may have, but these were all dissents, may have dissented to where I thought there was some slight doubt that you actually had the correct perpetrator. This court in a case said that's not going to count. So the majority of this court says that doesn't count if there's some nagging doubt in your mind I forget the correct legal term that we assigned to that, but
residual doubt.
Residual doubt, yes. But this court has said that doesn't count in this weighing process. I personally disagree and have indicated that. But has this court, do you recall, and as I say, I wouldn't expect you to have researched that. We know that juries do it. Juries do their duty on this because they don't always impose death when the prosecutor asks for it. And the defendant is legally qualified to receive death. So juries are doing this independent weighing. Perhaps occasionally trial judges are doing an independent weighing. I don't recall reading much of that happening where a trial judge, after the jury has said death, has actually made an independent determination death is inappropriate based on a weighing of mitigating and aggravating. But I assume it does happen on occasion. But what Mr. Gamzo has laid at our feet without saying so is you folks aren't doing your job on this question. And so that's why we're probing you on a question that you didn't really plan to come and argue much about.
I do recall there have been times, I recall, could be wrong, where the court has found that the aggravating circumstances outweigh the mitigating, or aggravating factors outweigh the mitigating circumstance, or aggravating circumstances, I should say, and it's very rare, but not just on the basis of background.
Mr. Pearson, in 2001, we had the case of State versus Murphy, and the quote here that the argument was the mitigating factor was neglected childhood. Clear that appellant grew up with little or no moral guidance. This is entitled to some weight, but we have seldom accorded strong weight to a defendant's childhood. And then the cases of Holloway, Cooey, Murphy, another Murphy, and Campbell are cited there. But the term was neglected childhood. Do you think that the record here, when we examine it, will fall within that category, or does this record show something more that would suggest a greater mitigating emphasis should be given?
Well, I'm not really sure what the court meant when it talked about the neglected childhood, you know. So, I mean, I would really have to
go back. The typical background, we know most of the time when we're looking at cases involving the death penalty, we are not going to have an individual who has what we'd call a pristine background. And generally speaking, mitigation will be presented during the defense case that shows how the defendant had neglect in the background. The parents fell short in many ways. There was no moral guidance. Certainly, this case, from what we have seen so far, provides more than that. Would you not agree?
I agree that it shows more than just neglect, sure. But I don't agree that it rises to the level where that background is so bad that it calls for not imposing, or I should say, that the court would actually be affirming the imposition of the death penalty that was decided by a jury, which, even though you're doing an independent weighing, I still think that the fact that not just one but two juries, a trial judge and three other appellate judges, have decided that this person is worthy of death is insignificant. They are the jury.
Now, that wouldn't be independent weighing, would it? If that's rattling around in the back of our mind.
Well, if independent weighing means you just forget about what happened in
I think that's what it means,
below,
isn't it?
I don't think that's what it means.
Well, then it would be some sort of review as to the appropriateness of the decision made below. That's not what the statute says.
Right. You do an independent weighing, but you're doing an independent weighing on a cold record. You haven't sat there. You haven't listened to the witnesses. You haven't seen the cross-examination or any of that sort of thing. So I suppose that if you want to look at it that way and just say, well, independent weighing means ignoring all of that.
Well, I don't think it's a matter if we want to. That's what the statute says, isn't it?
Well, it says that you have to conduct the independent weighing, but I think that you ought to be aware.
Where's the but in the statute?
The but is that you're looking at a cold record, and so when you do your independent weighing, I think you ought to take that into consideration.
Well,
so you can do your independent weighing, but take that into
consideration. We do that in all cases, look at a cold record,
sure.
And that's certainly what we have to do in a death penalty case. We have to review that record, and independent means we individually have to come to a determination of what we believe, putting aside what the others believed. And especially under this case, we have the benefit of a court of appeals decision. Now under the new law, we don't have that, and so we certainly are looking at a cold record and making that independent review, and that's what's required of us.
Mr. Pearson, if I could ask, is it the state's position that a bad background, no matter how difficult it is, can always be overcome and would never constitute sufficient mitigating evidence to outweigh an aggravating factor? Is that the state's position?
No, I don't believe that as a representative of the state I'm going to take that position at this time. No. I just would find it rather odd for this court to find that in this case, in light of the other cases that have come in front of it, where people have had much worse backgrounds than Troy Tenay's, and coupled usually with much more severe mental problems, this court is still given the background some weight, but has never reversed based on that. And
you're saying there has to be something more then.
If you're going to do it, it's got to be a worse scenario than what's offered in this particular case. Is what I'm saying essentially.
Mr. Pearson, was this case tried? It may be in the brief someplace. I may have missed it. Was this case tried after after jurors were given the authority to recommend life without parole, or before?
It's a pre-95 case, so that,
they
no,
did
that
not
was
have
not
the
an
option of life without parole.
That was not an option. No.
You've used your time.
I have.
Well, the red light's on. That's what that means.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you. Mr. Gamzo, you saved a little over 2 minutes of your time.
Thank you. Very briefly, in Mr. Pearson's position, his answer to your last question, Justice Lanzinger, finally is, well, it's never been enough before. And things may have been worse in some other cases. I can't answer that. It is my recollection, but again, I have not gone and actually checked it out, that this court has never reversed a death sentence purely on the basis of an appalling background. It has reversed a few on the basis that the aggravating circumstances do not outweigh the mitigating factors, never entirely on a bad background.
Well, Mr. Gamzo, would it be your contention, or is this a likely summation, that the background that this defendant suffered at the hands of his parents and significant adults from an early age, the drug abuse, lessons in how to be a criminal, excised any conscience, any knowledge of right and wrong, and this individual survived for 31 years with that portion of his abilities removed and
conscience, no. Or knowledge of right and wrong. And the record is I think, reasonably clear that Mr. Tenez understood the difference between right
Certainly.
And wrong. There's no challenge about that in here. Was he a person largely without conscience? I think largely without conscience. Entirely? I think probably not. I think the record indicates that he's not entirely without it.
So he had a conscience.
He had something of a conscience, and he did the wrong thing. And nobody's disputing that. I do have to say, for the record, that the one thing Mr. Pearson's right about is that we do not actually concede that he was properly convicted of aggravated murder. We don't think he was, but that's what he was convicted of. And unless you undo that conviction, then you nevertheless must make the independent determination here. And doing that, if I may finish my sentence, I know my time is up. In doing that, it seems to me that that background makes a difference. And it makes a difference, especially in the context of the whole case. You look at it all together. You make your independent determination. Juries are told that when they weigh the mitigating circumstance, each circumstance weighs whatever they choose to have it weigh. Each juror gets to decide, this one weighs this much to me, this one weighs that much to me. I'm suggesting that the same thing is true of aggravating circumstances. And what's true of juries is true of this court. They're not fungible. None of this is fungible. It's
long,
all independent and individual.
Sentence.
I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gamzo. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.